When I was in my mid-40s, I suddenly had this epiphany that there was probably more sand in the bottom of the hourglass than in the top. If I hadn't pursued the things that I always told myself I was going to do, then, you know, I was burning daylight and I'd better get cracking.
Hello, and welcome to episode 11 of the Mother of Reinvention show. I'm Megan Francis, your host, and in this podcast, we're talking about all the ways we reinvent our lives as our kids get older or as we move into our 40s and beyond. From career pivots to wellness journeys, new relationships, and whole new identities, this show is here to inspire you as you think about your what's next life. Well, we've all heard those late bloomer stories about the woman who doesn't pick up a paintbrush until she's pushing 50, and then the next thing you know, her stuff is in galleries everywhere, or someone who decides to bake a pie for their best friend, and then next thing you know, they're heading up a national corporation, right? But those stories can sometimes feel a bit like a fairy tale, not something that happens to a normal person from a normal place. And that is why I'm so excited about my guest today, Angeline Bulley, whose debut novel, Firekeeper's Daughter, published in March. Angeline got the idea for the book when she was 18, and then she went about her normal life. She got a job, she raised three kids, and all the while, this book idea was burning in the back of her mind. So she finally sat down to write at the age of 44, and then 11 years later, she sold it. And now at 56, she's been on the bestseller list for months, and her book is completely blowing up. So here's a little backstory. I stumbled across Angeline on Instagram just before her book launched, and for whatever reason, I clicked through to read more about her, which isn't something I would always do, but I just felt moved to. And when I did, I discovered a pretty amazing coincidence. Firekeeper's Daughter is set in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, which is where I grew up. So let me tell you about the Sioux, as it's locally nicknamed. It's in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, or as we call it here, the UP, which is a big, spacious, rugged, remote place that borders Canada and Wisconsin and is literally separated from the lower half of the state by a bridge. Winters up there are cold and intense and long, and there's a very cool history to the Sioux, including an American Indian presence that really defines the culture of the region in a way that's just different from any place else I've ever lived. It's wild and beautiful up there and has become even more special to me as I've gotten older. But here's the thing about the Sioux and the UP in general. It's kind of a quiet place. There aren't big cities or what you would term a cultural mecca up there. Most people have no idea where the UP is, and even a lot of lifelong lower Michigan residents have never even been across the bridge. So you don't see its people and places represented in the media too often, and you definitely don't hear about a lot of breakout authors who live in and write about the area. And as an American Indian, Angeline felt her voice was even less represented in popular culture. When she was a teenager, she got the idea to write what she referred to as an Indigenous Nancy Drew novel. And then she waited nearly three decades to get around to writing it. But when she did, wow, like I mentioned, it is blowing up. And I mean, when I say blowing up, I mean really blowing up. It's been on the New York Times bestseller list since it published in March. Reese Witherspoon picked it for her book club. And it's been optioned by Barack and Michelle Obama's production company, Higher Ground, to bring the book to Netflix as an original series. So this is an amazing success story that's playing out for a woman who is more than a decade older than I am, who's from the same place as me, and whose book is actually written about the town I grew up in. And if that is not a sign to chill out and stop worrying that I've somehow missed the boat, what is? I was so inspired by this interview with Angeline because she's just really frank and realistic about the fact that for many years, she had young kids and a regular job and just couldn't spend hours a day cranking out words. But she didn't just say, oh, well, I guess I'll never publish a novel. She sat with her idea and let it take life in her imagination even before she was able to actually sit down and write a single word. And then 2.5 decades after having the idea, when she finally saw it was time, she sat down to write and didn't get discouraged by clunky first drafts. She kept learning and working and shaping her craft. Finally, over a decade later, she sold her book and now she's having all this amazing success with it. I sometimes fall victim to thinking I have somehow missed an opportunity, or if I don't move on something fast, I won't have a chance again. But Angeline's story is such a great example of how it's really never too late to jump in or jump back in. Maybe you're a writer at heart, but you haven't had time to write in a long time. Maybe you haven't even had time to read in a long time. But we all go through seasons in our lives, and for most of us, there are still many seasons left to create and reinvent. That said, I love that Angeline had a moment where she realized, hey, life isn't going to last forever and it's time to get moving. Imagine if instead Angeline had thought, well, I missed my opportunity, too late now. If she hadn't decided to sit down at 44 and finally start getting this book written, she'd still be 56 now, only without a published New York Times bestselling novel. So if you know it's time, it's time. And it doesn't matter how much time you spent not doing the thing before that. I know you're going to love this interview with Angeline Bulley, but first I want to talk about our sponsor, PrepDish. As I've mentioned, one of my summer goals is to not let my eating habits go completely off the rails just because people are going to restaurants again. And I love eating out. But I also notice that when I eat away from home too often, I start to feel crummy, and not to mention, I spend way too much money. When life gets really busy, to me, the key to healthy eating is to have a plan, and PrepDish is such a great solution. PrepDish is a subscription meal planning and menu service that makes it really easy to plan and prep meals for the whole week all at once. Every week, founder and dietitian Allison sends you four complete menus: keto, paleo, gluten-free, and their new super fast menus. They come to your email along with recipes and a grocery list. The menus are delicious, with meals like Hawaiian chicken wraps with grilled zucchini and summer squash skewers from next week's paleo menu, and you can mix and match between the four different menus so you don't have to stick with just one. And once you have the grocery list and the menus, the idea is that you shop and you do all your prep at once, so then anytime you want to make dinner, you just pull out the prepped meal and you're good to go. For a free 2-week trial, go to prepdish.com/more. That's M-O-R for Mother of Reinvention. Again, just head to prepdish.com/more, M-O-R, to try PrepDish free for 2 weeks. Okay, I hope you enjoy my discussion with Angeline Bulley.
Welcome, Angeline. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I am really excited about this because, first of all, I mean, there's a lot of interesting ways that our stories kind of intersect, but also I just love this story that you have of starting writing, you know, in your 40s after probably having done a lot of the heavy lifting of raising a young family, writing this book and then still taking another more than 10 years to like get published in the way you were looking for, and then having it completely blow up. So it sounds like you've been through quite a ride for the last month or so with The Firekeeper's Daughter. So just tell us what life has been like for you since publication and how the book is doing, and just give us an update on all that.
Well, my book, Firekeeper's Daughter, it published on March 16th, and it's been so exciting. It debuted at number one on the New York Times bestseller list, and it was number two its second week out. And then in the 7 weeks since it launched, it's been in the top three. And I just cannot. I dream big, and this is beyond any dream that I had. I always knew it was a really great story. But seeing the response, just like you said, blow up, it's surreal. It's still surreal.
I can't even imagine. So tell us about the story that you're talking about. And I just want to say really quick that this book is set where I grew up, in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, where a lot of people, we refer to it as the Sioux. And so much of it has been, I'm like halfway through it right now, and just like the setting and all the people, it's so recognizable to me, and I love that. And I think that authenticity really does speak to people, and I think that's a big part of the book's success. But tell us about the main character, the journey, the people of this book, for people who maybe aren't familiar with what it's like living up there in Sault Ste. Marie.
Sure. So I pitched my book as Indigenous Nancy Drew, and it's really, though, a genre-defying book. It's part thriller, part mystery, part coming of age. There's some romance. It was really hard to really say that it was any one genre. But it is. It's young adult, and yet it's young adult crossover, which means it's likely to appeal to adults as much as teens. And it tells a story of 18-year-old Donis Fontaine, Her father is Ojibwe and her mother is non-native and from a wealthy family in town. And so Donis has always grown up feeling like she has a foot in each, you know, community, but yet doesn't feel fully accepted in either. And she witnesses a devastating murder and learns about an investigation that's going on that's trying to get to the bottom of who is distributing a deadly new drug in Sault Ste. Marie. And so she reluctantly agrees to be a confidential informant for the FBI. And she quickly realizes that there are two investigations going on, theirs and hers. And all of the things about herself that she thought wasn't enough, or, you know, she's a science geek, she played hockey on the boys' varsity team for 4 years, she knows traditional Ojibwe plants and medicines, that all of these things make her the ideal person to figure out what's going on and protect her tribal community. So I wanted Donis to be, her identity to be like a microcosm of Sault Ste. Marie. So she has, you know, an Ojibwe father, and then her mom is, she has a French, you know, grandmother and an Italian grandfather. And so she really does represent these major influences that's part of Sault Ste. Marie's history. And I thought it was interesting to play with the identity of a community personified in the main character and have that be part of the character's journey, is claiming her identity and, you know, making peace with that. Mm. And as far as being the enrollment issue, so there are 574 federally recognized tribes in the United States, not counting Native Hawaiians. So it's American Indian and Alaska Native tribes, bands, communities. And every tribe has the sovereign right to determine who is a member. And so that's why some tribes require a blood quantum requirement, where one parent must be full blood or a grandparent must have been full blood. And we get into percentages, and then other tribes do their membership based on lineal descent. So you don't have to meet a certain blood quantum criteria, but you do have to trace your family tree to a native who was listed on one of the Durant rolls, which the federal government would take these like census rolls of who was living in a tribal community in the 1800s. And so if you can trace your person to that, then you meet the criteria for membership. And I thought it was really interesting, because Donis is grappling with her identity, to have her not be an enrolled tribal member, so that I could talk about the ways in which people are excluded for reasons that have nothing to do with them. And she's a person who, she knows her Ojibwe language, she knows traditional medicines, but yet she's not an enrolled member.
Yeah. I know that she encounters a lot of discrimination and racism, and I want to just, again, kind of circle back to how prominent that can really be in a place where the racial makeup is so different than it might be in other areas. And I definitely remember that as being a tension point, even just when I was a kid. I only lived there till I was 13, but what might that look like for a character like Donis in her community, and how does she deal with that in the book?
Well, I have where her grandparents, her non-native grandparents, did not like Indian people. And they especially didn't like a poor boy from the reservation who knocked up their 16-year-old daughter. So, you know, Donis feels like she loves her grandparents, her maternal grandparents, but she also knows that they view her Indianness as an obstacle that she has to overcome, and that she has to be the best. She has to be the valedictorian. She has to excel, because they want her to be one of the good Indians.
Okay.
And she buys into it, but she doesn't feel like she knows that there that it's not right. Or she struggles with how do you love someone, but they don't like parts. Like, she knows her grandparents loved her, but she also knows that they did not like a very significant part of her. Mm-hmm. And then she talks about the less frequent, but more heartbreaking instances of when her firekeeper family views her as a white person first and as one of them second. Mm-hmm. And so she has grown up with this feeling of always being not enough or too much or just not being able to feel comfortable in her skin, I guess. And what that identity means reflected by those around her that she loves.
Yeah. You had mentioned that, well, first of all, you mentioned that you dream big, and I love that, and that you started writing at 44, and I did a little quick math, so I know your kids that you told me right before we started recording are 22, 26, and 27, which means you really didn't start writing until they were well into their, preteen and teen years, it sounds like. And right. I'm curious, is this a story or is this the kind of story that was like rattling around in your head the whole time? I know so many of our listeners will be able to really relate to that period of time when your arms are full, your time is full, you're doing the diapering and the cooking and the running all around. And maybe there's this thing kind of burning in the background that you really want to get to, or maybe it's a little vaguer. And I'm curious how that looked for you. Like, did you know you wanted to sit down and write a young adult novel and it was going to have these themes? Or was it more like, I just want to write and I don't know what that's going to look like, but I'm just going to do it and see what happens?
I wanted to write an Indigenous Nancy Drew story. I grew up reading a lot. My mother and father were both, huge readers, and they still are. But I was 18 before I read a story that had a Native main character. And I found that it wasn't until I read one that I realized I hadn't read one up to that point. Yeah. And so that always kind of struck me as odd. And then I had the idea for the story when I was 18 also. So one of my friends went to a different high school and told me about a new guy, and it was our senior year, and I was intrigued, but then I found out that he didn't play any sports and he hung out with the stoners, and so that wasn't my type after all, and so I never met him. And then my friend told me at the end of the school year that there had been a huge drug bust, and it turned out that the new guy had been an undercover officer. And I remembered thinking at the time, what if I'd gone to that school, or what if I had just met him, and what if we liked each other? And then really the spark of an idea was, what if it wasn't that he liked me, but that he needed my help? And, my overactive imagination just kept like trying to think of different situations of why, me, this ordinary Ojibwe girl, would need to be part of some investigation. And that always stayed with me. Yeah. And then my career, I worked for Indian tribes. I've always worked for Indian tribes, and I would see different issues in communities. And I thought, ooh, what if it was a federal investigation? What if the main character was someone that they needed her help because something cultural happened, and she knows her culture and her language and the medicines, and so that it was kind of like making these puzzle pieces, finding out and shaping them and seeing how they would fit together. And so I didn't start writing until I was 44, but I think that I, on some level, I was creating the story in my mind and working through things ever since I was 18.
Wow. I love that, because I so often will tell people that writing sometimes doesn't look like writing. it doesn't look like sitting in front of a computer necessarily and pounding on the keys, right? There's like so much going on under the surface.
Right.
Yeah. And you've been working on that whole time. That's amazing.
Yeah. And I used to feel badly that I didn't have formal training. I don't have an MFA. But then I realized that in every job I've had working for tribes, I've done a lot of grant writing. And when you write a grant, you're competing against other worthy applicants.
Yeah.
And you have to create a compelling narrative to someone who knows nothing about your community. And you have to state, you know, what your need is and tell the story about your community and why you need the grant funding and what you're going to do with it. And I realized that I have been a writer all these years. I just have been telling a story. I haven't been writing poetry or short stories, but I've been writing these narratives about issues in the community and how the community is addressing it. And that, I think, defining that for me, or it took away any stigma I may have felt when I was around other writers and knowing, feeling out of sorts at first because I didn't have an MFA or I hadn't majored in, you know, English literature or creative writing. But realizing that my background and my experience was valid. It was a valid form of storytelling.
I think I would argue that many writers who have been through an MFA program or a very prestigious program would really envy that ability to learn through not just telling, weaving that narrative, like you said, like knowing the people you're talking about and then telling their story in a compelling way so you can compete, right? But also just knowing them, having the time and the ability. I mean, that's a long time to sit with a story and have the patience to let it unfold. And I think often writers feel a lot of pressure to get a story out there, just some anything to kind of justify what they, like their education, or maybe they had a debut when they were young and then they have to kind of like have their follow-up right away. And I can just see that adding a lot of pressure when there's not enough stories yet there. Like that you don't have enough experience to go by, and you've got all this experience now, all these people that you know and stories that you've heard and absorbed. And I just actually think that's probably puts you in an enviable position to a lot of writers.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. And then when we get back, we're going to tell more of the story of what happened after Angeline decided to finally start getting words down at the age of 44. Of course, you already know that she didn't go straight from her first draft to amazing success. So what did that process look like? You'll learn more after we come back from this sponsor break. Friends, you have already heard me raving about my Amy Wedges from Vionic Shoes. But besides looking cute when I go out, summer is a really active time for me too, and it's important that I have sneakers and sandals that are cute and comfy. That's why I have my eye on two new pair of Vionic shoes, the Adore Active Sneaker, which is a streamlined, colorful pastel sneaker that is super breathable and flexible, and the Tiffany Sandal, which is a colorful neoprene slide-on T-strap sandal with an adjustable fit. Between the two, I feel like I'll have nearly every laid-back summer day need covered, from slipping on sandals to head to the beach or sliding into a pair of sneakers to walk the dog. And since every single pair of Vionics takes comfort to the maximum level, I know they'll have my back with their three-zone comfort featuring stability, cushioning, and amazing arch support. If you've been thinking about trying a pair of Vionics but haven't taken the plunge yet, check this out. They have a 30-day wear test, so you can return for a full refund within 30 days if you aren't satisfied for any reason, even if you've worn them outside. Go to VionicShoes.com and use promo code MORE, that's M-O-R, to get free shipping on your pair of Vionics. Again, that's VionicShoes.com and use the promo code M-O-R for free shipping. Not surprisingly, I consume a lot of audio content. Whether I'm listening to music when I run or podcasts when I walk the dog or just long voice messages from my business partner, Sarah, it seems like I'm always listening to something, and often while I'm doing something else. That is why I've become such a fan of Studio. Studio makes amazing wireless Bluetooth earbuds that I've been using for years now, and they're always outdoing themselves by coming up with new and better models. My current go-to is a Studio Et. First of all, I want to mention how comfortable they are going in, because that's a big factor for me, and I cannot stand the kind that hurt my ear holes. The Et style comes with 8 different soft silicone ear tips to choose from, That's the little part that goes in your ear, so you can find out what fits best so they don't hurt or fall out. The Etz charge wirelessly, and you get a lot of use out of a single charge, and they have a long range, so you could really wander away from your phone while you're, you know, puttering around your house, and you won't lose your signal. And they're water resistant, which is great if you sweat a lot or walk in the rain. Here's another thing I think is really cool. You know how sometimes noise-canceling earbuds are great for listening to music, but then you try to say something and it feels like you're talking inside your own sinus cavity? Studio Etz have what they call active noise canceling, which means you can be listening to music on the noise-canceling setting and then switch to transparency mode to take a call. It lets in just a little ambient noise so you can hear your own voice, and trust me, it makes it a lot less weird. The Studio Etz model is now available for their lowest price ever at only $129. And with our 15% discount code, that's going to bring it down to $110. When you purchase the Etz, you'll also get the option to pick up their wireless charger for 50% off. To get that 15% off your purchase, visit studio.com and use the code podcast at checkout. Again, it's studio.com and the code is podcast for 15% off. Okay, back to my interview with Angeline Bulley.
So you started storytelling at 18, or started putting the story together at 18, but really didn't sit down and start putting it to paper till 44. What did that look like? Like, that's a year older than I am. And I'm trying to think, you know, even though I've been a writer for most of my adult life, I've never written a piece of fiction. It's one of those things I've walked around thinking, I think I have it in me, but what would it take for me to sit down and put the work in now? I mean, you know, was there a shift? Did your kids all go to summer camp? Like, what happened that made that happen for you, or made you feel like now's the time?
This is kind of a hard thing to admit, but I don't know if it was like this midlife crisis or what, but when I was in my mid-40s, I suddenly had this epiphany that there was probably more sand in the bottom of the hourglass than in the top. Yeah. And if I hadn't pursued the things that I always told myself I was going to do, then, you know, I was burning daylight and I'd better get cracking. And my daughter was a preteen. My sons were, you know, in their teen years. And I was like, I'm going to write that Indigenous Nancy Drew story. And by the time I finish it, my daughter will be ready to read it. She'll be, you know, in high school, and I'll be able to tell her all these things about being a strong Ojibwe young woman. And so that was really it was a combination of looking at my life and what I had accomplished, and I was proud of the things I had accomplished, but knowing that I had not started to write the story yet, and I'd been doing all of this thinking, and I really wanted to show my daughter that I was pursuing this. You know, she heard me talk about the story, and so yeah, I think that was kind of the impetus.
Yeah. I love that there was more sand in the bottom of the hour. I think most of us get to a point where we're like, oof, like if we said we were going to do the thing, at some point we have to do the thing.
Yeah.
But it still took you kind of a long time. So you thought you would wrap the book up by the time your daughter was in high school. Did you do that?
No, I didn't. Okay. I wrote a draft and it was bad. It was really bad, but I didn't get discouraged. I was like, no, I know that there is a good story here. I need to improve my writing. And so I read some books on about the craft of writing. And then I geared up and I dove back in and did like a page one rewrite. So a complete start from scratch, next draft. And then I read that. And I thought, no, my dialogue is really, I don't think my dialogue's really hitting it. And so I'd learn more about dialogue and learn about conflict and pacing and plot beats and how to construct a story. And I would just be teaching myself all of these things that I would know when I finished a draft. I would know that something was off, and I would know what wasn't working, what I wasn't happy with. And so I would teach myself about it. I'd go back and look at books that I loved the dialogue, and I'd break it down. I'd reread the stories that I loved, but I'd read them as a writer and studying what made that storytelling so, why did I love that so much? Why did I remember the dialogue in a certain book? Why did, and so it was 10 years of that, of finishing a draft, being real honest with myself about what wasn't working, and then trying to get the tool, the resources to figure it out, and then attacking it again. I didn't know it would take 10 years.
Right.
It was all, yeah, I did not know. It was always like, my next draft will be my last draft. Like, I'm going to get it right the next time. And then I wouldn't be ready, or I wouldn't feel it was ready. There were people that I let read the story that thought, oh, this is great. This is great. You should get an agent. You should try to get it published. But I didn't think it was ready. And so it wasn't until 10 years and I had participated. I had been selected for the We Need Diverse Books Young Adult Mentorship Program.
How did you, because what this sounds like is you were probably kind of like going about your life and work, you know, writing when you had set aside time and thinking I'm sure that 10 years, though you didn't expect it to take that long, maybe in some ways doesn't even feel like 10 years went past because you're in the zone, you're working, you're in that flow of just constantly trying to get to the next place and sounds like you were very focused and, I don't know, it sounds like very methodical. Like you went through and were like, I don't like this dialogue. I'm going to learn how to do that. I don't think I know enough about plot pacing. I'm going to learn more about that. So for you to even have been considered for the program you just mentioned, the We Need Diverse Books program, you must have been putting yourself out there to someone to be considered for that. So was this a networking thing? Were you building your writer community? How were you getting those opportunities?
Well, living in Sault Ste. Marie at that time, I hadn't really found my community, my writing community. Mm-hmm. I had met some writers, but I really wanted a writing community that was native. I just didn't want to explain or validate, and I just wanted there to be that shorthand understanding of writing about your tribal community and not having to spend energy explaining things.
Yeah.
And so I had heard about the We Need Diverse Books mentorship program, and I applied in 2017 and I did not get selected. And I was really bummed about it. And then in 2018, on Twitter, there were some Native writers that I followed, and one of them tweeted something about this writing retreat that was called Loonsong Turtle Island. And it was a writing retreat for Native writers. It was going to be on this lake in northern Minnesota. Mm. And I was like, I'd never been to a writer's conference or anything before. And I thought, this is it. This is it. And it was magical. It was so good. And the faculty that worked the retreat, they looked at my writing sample and got to know me. And then I had said something about We Need Diverse Books and that I hadn't been picked for that mentorship. And they said, apply again. And I did. And I could even see in the writing sample that I had submitted in 2017 and the sample I had submitted in 2018, I could see my growth as a writer in that time. And I felt really good about, you know, and so I did get selected for the program on my second time trying for it.
Wow. So this is definitely a story of persistence and perseverance. I mean, a lot of people wouldn't even stick with a writing project for a month, a year, and you really stuck with it for 10 before it really bore the fruit you were looking for. So let's talk about that really quick. So the book got published when you were 55. You said you're turning 56 tomorrow. So yes. By the time this episode airs, you'll be 56. So it took 10 years. I'm going to guess just by the the length of time it takes for something to go from, you know, getting accepted by a publisher to being published, that it actually was probably accepted for publication, picked up like about a year plus ago. How long ago was that?
Yeah, the book deal, the book auction happened October of 2019.
Okay. So October of 2019. So that's about nine and a half years, something like that. Between, you know, I'm not 100% sure how it all shakes out, but you know, around a decade, right? So
yeah.
So you got yourself an agent, I'm assuming. You got in front of the publishers. It went to auction, which is a huge deal for writers. Like, you really want your book to go to auction. That means people are really fighting over it, and that's great. What was that process like for you? And keeping in mind, too, this whole 10 years, like, your kids are getting older. They're becoming young adults. They're moving off into the world on their own. You've got a lot going on. So how is your writing? How was your writing life kind of moving along beside all that?
During the 10 years, I'm not a morning person, but I started getting up earlier so that I could drink my coffee and get on the computer and write before the kids got up and we started our day, went to school and work and all of that, because the jobs that I had were always, pretty intense leadership positions, and I would be exhausted at the end of the day. And so for me, the most alert and creative time was that early morning. And so then I started wanting to get up earlier so that I could write for 2 hours before the kids got up. But then there were times, like, you know, when I went through my divorce, there were times when I'd have to set the story aside.
Yeah.
Sometimes life happens and my energy needed to be focused on, you know, my kids and the changes that we're going through at time. So there were times I would set it aside for a couple of months. But then I would always come back to it because I knew there was something there. I knew there was something special about this story, about this girl, and that it was more than a thriller about an undercover investigation. It was really a bigger story about claiming one's identity when you feel like you don't belong in a community, and how you claim that.
So you mentioned that you had gone through a divorce during this process. When did that happen?
It happened early in the process. I think I had written one or two drafts at that time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Did you find that having the book to return to was like an important part of sort of your, I don't know, rediscovery of yourself after divorce? I know a lot of our listeners are divorced. I'm divorced. And it's so common that that's a big part of this, you know, 40s plus reinvention story. And I'm wondering if the book helped keep you grounded during that phase.
Yes. Even when I would set it aside and I wouldn't be writing, I could not escape, you know, it would be in my dreams. A character revelation would come to me, and that would make me eager to get back to it.
Yeah. Do you think there's another, I know that there are some novelists who are able to crank books out fairly quickly. You don't seem necessarily like one of those, but maybe you could be, right, going forward. So I'm wondering if, you know, I know there's a lot of pressure on successful novelists to follow it up. And I wonder if you feel like you're going to be on that path, or are you going to just kind of do things at your pace? Like, what do you think is next for you?
Well, when I was certain that the book would get published, I just didn't know, you know, by who or what. Like, I knew it was going to be a reality. I thought, well, maybe this is it. Maybe I just have one story in me and it's just one hell of a great story.
Yeah.
And that's that. And so I was living in DC at the time, and I actually living in Alexandria, Virginia, and I was going out for a walk, and I was, all of a sudden, this character popped into my head, and it was like the opening line of her story. And she said, "I stole everything they think I did and even stuff they don't know about." And okay. I thought, who is this? who is this? And so I ran into the nearest business, and it was this cheese bar that's called Cheese Teak. And it's like there's a bar and a restaurant and a cheese deli. And anyway,
I need to go there. That sounds fantastic. Cheese. Okay.
It is. And I ran in and I ran up to the bar, and they said, and I, when I walk, I usually just keep like my ID and my credit card tucked in my bra or something. Right. And I had my cell phone with me, and that was it. And so I ran into the bar and I was like, I need a piece of paper and a pen. I'll also take a Chardonnay. And I literally sat at that bar. And I wrote this like stream of consciousness of this young woman sitting in a police station. And she's like, how did it come to this? And her voice was so different from Donna's. And that I knew what her story was going to be. And to me, that was the first day that I truly felt like a writer, where I was like, I've got more in me.
Wow. It's not just this one story that's been following you around since you were 18 years old. There's more stories to come. And maybe, you know, I think that there's so much to this idea. And I struggle with the phrase late bloomer, because it makes it sound like you weren't doing anything all the rest of that time. And you were doing so many things, and you were raising a family, and that's super important. And your career was important and all that stuff. But this one aspect, it just took a while to congeal. Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. But yeah, now you're there. Yeah.
I've had conversations like with my editor and my agent before. And there, I want to say something about like my age. It's when editors were interested in my writing, they talked about how confident my voice was as a writer. The choices that I made in the story and the risks that I took as a writer. And I think that came from my age and experience, honestly. I think that when I was younger, I was maybe more about pleasing people and doing more of what I thought was right rather than what I felt was right. And, you know, for lack of a better word, being, you know, in my 50s by that time, it was more of like, I'm telling the story I want to tell, and I have faith that the right publisher is going to, you know, see the value of the story. But if not, I'm, you know, I'll self-publish, I'll do this, I'll do that. Like, if the story is going to be in print, it's just a matter of, you know, who and when. And so that confidence, I think, set me apart from others who might be like, I'm going to take the first offer that comes. I'm going to take the first agent that offers. It was like, no, I'm going to make the right decisions, and being confident in that.
Confident and unhurried. And it sounds like that really served you very well, just taking your time. Because decisions like that do take time. I mean, just choosing an agent, if they're going to be a champion for you or not, or a champion for the right the thing that you want and need them to be and not what they think that you should be, you know? So all of that, really, those are big decisions. It sounds like you were able to make them slowly and with care, which I think is something that gets easier with age.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
So how would you, just to kind of wrap up, I know so many of the stories that I've been sharing on this podcast this season have been about just resilience and grit and perseverance. And your story is definitely shows all three of those. But I'm wondering what you would say to a listener who's maybe back where you were when you saw that the sands at the bottom of the hourglass were bigger than the ones left at the top, or having that moment of just saying, wow, like, life is finite. This isn't going to last forever. Like, how do you let that light a fire under you, no pun intended, or maybe pun completely intended, without it, you know, without it making you like burn up or like run toward the wrong things. Like you felt the fire at 44 and then you let it slowly burn for 10 years. And I just think that's so fascinating and very, very hard to do. Often when we suddenly feel an urge we feel like we have to run toward it really fast and hard. And how did you both feel the urgency, but let it unfold? And how would you share, you know, how to help others in that same situation do the same thing?
I think that that whole finite, you know, there are only enough hours in the day. There's only enough, and it's okay to take a rest. It's okay to be tired. It's okay to decide not to pursue something. I wanted to be very deliberate that if I thought about it and decided not to write the story, I wanted that to be a deliberate decision so that I wouldn't have any regret about it. Because I feel like sometimes you make a decision and then later you think that was the wrong decision, but it was the best decision at that time with the information that you had. So you have to let go of that what if. And so I always found it easier for me to accept. And I don't like having regrets about things I didn't do. I'd rather regret the things I did. Wait, yeah. Is that how I want to say
that? Yeah, I think that's right. Yes.
And so I just wanted to know that if you be honest about your what you have the energy to do, and if you decide that this is something that you want to pursue, make that choice. But if you decide that honestly you don't have, you know, maybe that dream has died, or maybe there's something else I would rather do, say yes to, then accept it and be kind to yourself and don't beat yourself up about that path not taken, because the path that that you do go on, you know, that's a good place to be too. So
yeah,
I don't know. I feel like I'm rambling and not really expressing it, but it's more about making those deliberate decisions and then not beating yourself up afterwards.
Well, because there's any number of hundreds of or millions of things we all could potentially do in our lives, but we can't do all of them. And so maybe the thing that you, like for you, you know, you had a story burning in you from the age of 18 and that didn't go away, but maybe someone else has cycled through lots of potential things. And now the thing they thought they wanted is maybe not the thing. But you know, what I loved hearing in your story was that you wanted it enough that you were willing to keep going back and shaping it and, you know, trying new things and educating yourself and learning and like putting yourself out there. And I think that's how you know it's the right thing. When you are still willing to do that, then you're on the right path. If not, then it's okay. Find something else, right? There's so many things to try, so many things to dip our toes into.
And I would say, like, don't fall in the trap of being like, but I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to do that. Think about yes. And by saying no to these things, it opens up this yes, like the thing I really want to do. And so I guess accepting that the no's, you know, are serving a purpose because they're giving space and energy in your life for the yes.
I love it. Well, Angeline, this has been so inspiring. Thank you so much for talking with me today. If listeners are looking, you know, besides being able to find your book literally everywhere in the world that books are sold, and you know, where can they catch up with you? Are you're active on Twitter, I think, right? Anyplace else?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at FineAngeline, like fine wine, Angeline. So
it's like Sweet Caroline, only it's Fine Angeline.
Yeah, it's Fine Angeline.
Yes, I love it. Okay.
And then I'm also on Instagram at Angeline Boley. I have an author website at Angeline, my website is angelineboley.com.
Okay.
And believe it or not, I did my first TikTok.
Oh my goodness. It is never too late. Okay. So I still have not done a TikTok, but the kids keep trying to get me to do one. And maybe one day I'll, you know, it's never too late, right? Were you dancing?
I did five of them. I was in Sault Ste. Marie for the book launch. And so I went to different places that I had written about in the book. And I was like, there's the parking lot behind LSSU Student Union. And this is the part where where Donis punches Jamie. Woo! And then I'm like, here's a freighter going by and the Sugar Island Ferry. Woo! Yes, you know, so it was just kind of silly little location things connected to the book.
Okay, well, I am going to have to track that down and maybe I can link it up in the show notes. And I'll definitely have a link to your website and all the other stuff in the show notes too so people can check you out. But this has been so great. I really appreciate talking to you today and I can't wait to see where your career goes next.
Thank you so much.
Well, thanks everyone for listening to this episode of Mother of Reinvention. Like always, everything from today's episode will be in the show notes at motherofreinventionshow.com. And again, don't forget to check out PrepDish. For a free 2-week trial, you can go to prepdish.com/more. That's M-O-R. Again, just head to prepdish.com/MOR to try PrepDish free for 2 weeks. All right, talk to you next Thursday.